You are listening to WXRW LP Milwaukee, 104.1 FM and RiverWestRadio.com globally. All archived shows available at creamcitymedia.com/anti. Hello once again, I'm your host NTSC, and you are listening to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom here on WXRW LP Milwaukee. Okay, so as usual, I've been super busy this week, and I have not had nearly enough time as necessary to produce a well-researched, well-argued show. But that's fine, because we're going to do another episode of what I like to call the Anarchist Book Corner. We'll be reading an essay by anthropologist David Graeber, who we talk about pretty frequently on the show. It'll be an essay called Hope in Common. But first, let's talk a little bit about what has been happening recently globally. I had a great time participating, there's the word, in the climate strike on the 20th. And we are in the midst of the climate strike on the 27th. So this is truly a global movement. It is a confederation of a group of different organizations all coming together in defense of our shared natural heritage. This, our one and only Earth. Hopefully you've heard of this by now. It confuses and surprises me to no end when family and friends still have not heard of Earthstrike or Extinction Rebellion or Greta Thunberg or any of the other stuff that's been going on. But it should not surprise me too dramatically, because this information and knowledge of these movements is specifically being withheld. It's not being talked about as heavily as it could be on all the media outlets, et cetera, because they exist only to continue and defend the status quo. And we've talked about this in essentially every episode. You know, this may as well be called the Broken Record Radio Hour at this point, because I rail against capital and I rail against, you know, power structures and all the same stuff every single show. But I'll tell you what, repetition is important. It's really crucial that we talk about these issues, we organize around them continuously, and scientifically, because the enemy, and you know, I hate to make, you know, black and white rigid dichotomies like this, but there is an enemy that we are facing. There is a class war raging, whether you want to believe it or not. And the other side knows that they're in a class war. And they're doing their damnedest to make it look like we're not. But anyway, this kind of stuff is not going to be in the mainstream media as much as it should be. Because, you know, quote unquote, the revolution will not be televised. That's what you hear all the time, right? But the strike of the 20th... gave me some hope. It made me feel like there are more people who agree with me than there are who disagree. I was able to represent the IWW's Environmental Unionist Caucus, of which I've just become a part. I designed and printed out a bunch of flyers, and I handed them out to people, and I had some pretty good conversations with some folks. My general spiel was pretty simple, similar to something that you've heard me talk about here on this radio show pretty often, and that's just that, you know, we're all in this together. We absolutely can no longer rely on the empty promises of politicians who have proven time and again that they have nobody's best interests at heart but their own and their true constituents, which are lobbyists and the enormous corporations whom they represent. And I approached some people on the 20th that I was expecting to disagree with me. What was I basing that on? I was basing it on their t-shirts, you know, what was printed on their hats. What did their signs say that they were carrying? And I thought, you know, all right, this person's probably gonna primarily approach this issue of global climate change from a strictly political stance. They're probably going to try and appeal to authority, and that's where their conversation is going to end. I was expecting that. But when I would use phrases like, we can no longer rely on politicians to solve this problem for us, we need to organize ourselves. And I would specifically use the term, the working class needs to organize ourselves to face this problem seriously. More people than not agreed. They said, you know what? You're right. The politicians have proved themselves to be generally useless in this regard. And then they'd take a flyer and then maybe they'd grab a few more to show to friends and family. And it was really emboldening. Friends and family came with me as well as some other union members. And we all got to talk with people. And I put my niece and nephew to work handing out flyers and beginning discussions. And that was especially emboldening for me because they and their generation will absolutely be the most affected by global climate change, especially those in the global South, which we are lucky not to be in. You know, I mean, I hate to say that, but we kind of lucked out being born here in the global North. There's a lot of ways that I lucked out, but yeah, that's for another episode. So today's essay that we're going to read again by David Graeber is going to talk about hope. It's going to talk about how this machine in which we all exist and struggle has been perniciously designed to create hopelessness, to create feelings of powerlessness, to drive the nail into your head that tells you you have no direct power in this system, and it is good that you have no direct power. They want you to think that it is important that you defer to the power of another. Oh, but you got to elect that person. So really, they're you. They speak for you. And obviously, they don't. This machine of surveillance and propaganda is trying to make you feel powerless and hopeless. And the fact of the matter is, there are gains being won all over the world. And they're happening in places that you never would have thought they might happen. And they're being enacted by people who have no ideological similarity with me. They wouldn't call themselves anarchists. They might not even know what the hell anarchism is, or what its tenets are, or what its history is. But they know what democracy is. They know what it feels like, or they're beginning to learn what it feels like to put into practice direct democracy, where they have a say in the modes and methodology of production in their lives, where they are beginning to take back their control over their destiny and over the destinies of their friends and families and the people with whom they're working. So maybe next week I'll be able to have a more researched episode. But for now, we're going to fall back on the Anarchist Book Corner, and we're really very lucky to be able to do so because there's a lot of really, really good stuff, thankfully, out there on the internet to be found. But most importantly, don't forget, get out from behind your computer screens. Get out into these marches. Get out into these rallies. Strike against your place of work. Strike against this terrible system of structural violence that we find ourselves in. Meet one another where you are. Help one another where you are, and we'll make a better world. Let's jump into the Anarchist Book Corner for this week, shall we? Hope in Common by David Graeber, first released on infoshop.org. We seem to have reached an impasse. Capitalism, as we know it, appears to be coming apart. But as financial institutions stagger and crumble, there is no obvious alternative. Organized resistance appears scattered and incoherent. The global justice movement is a shadow of its former self. There's good reason to believe that in a generation or so, capitalism will no longer exist, for the simple reason that it's impossible to maintain an engine of perpetual growth forever on a finite planet. Faced with the prospect, the knee-jerk reaction, even of progressives, is often fear. To cling to capitalism because they simply can't imagine an alternative that wouldn't be even worse. The first question we should be asking is, how did this happen? Is it normal for human beings to be unable to imagine what a better world would even be like? Hopelessness isn't natural. It needs to be produced. If we really want to understand this situation, we have to begin by understanding that the last 30 years have seen the construction of a vast bureaucratic apparatus for the creation and maintenance of hopelessness. A kind of giant machine that is designed, first and foremost, to destroy any sense of possible alternative futures. At root is a veritable obsession on the part of the rulers of the world with ensuring that social movements cannot be seen to grow, to flourish, to propose alternatives, that those who challenge existing power arrangements can never, under any circumstances, be perceived to win. To do so requires a vast apparatus of armies, prisons, police, various forms of private security firms, and police and military intelligence apparatus, propaganda engines of every conceivable variety, most of which do not attack alternatives directly so much as they create a pervasive climate of fear, jingoistic conformity, and a simple despair that renders any thought of changing the world seem an idle fantasy. Maintaining this apparatus seems even more important to exponents of the quote-unquote free market. It seems more important even than maintaining any sort of viable market economy. How else can one explain, for instance, what happened in the former Soviet Union, where one would have imagined the end of the Cold War would have led to the dismantling of the army and KGB and rebuilding the factories, but in fact, what happened was precisely the other way around. This is just one extreme example of what has been happening everywhere. Economically, this apparatus is pure dead weight. All the guns, surveillance cameras, and propaganda engines are extraordinarily expensive and really produce nothing. And as a result, it's dragging the entire capitalist system down with it and possibly the earth itself. The spirals of financialization and endless string of economic bubbles we've been experiencing are a direct result of this apparatus. It's no coincidence that the United States has become both the world's major military, quote-unquote, security power, and the major promoter of bogus securities. This apparatus exists to shred and pulverize the human imagination, to destroy any possibility of envisioning alternative futures. As a result, the only thing left to imagine is more and more money, and debt spirals entirely out of control. What is debt, after all, but imaginary money whose value can only be realized in the future? Future profits, the proceeds of the exploitation of workers not yet born. Finance capital, in turn, is the buying and selling of these imaginary future profits. And once one assumes that capitalism itself will be around for all eternity, the only kind of economic democracy left to imagine is one everyone is equally free to invest in the market, to grab their own piece in the game of buying and selling imaginary future profits, even if these profits are to be extracted from themselves. Freedom has become the right to share in the proceeds of one's own permanent enslavement. And since the bubble had built on the destruction of futures, once it collapsed, there appeared to be, at least for the moment, simply nothing left. The effect, however, is clearly temporary. If the story of the global justice movement tells us anything, it's that the moment there appears to be any sense of an opening, the imagination will immediately spring forth. This is what effectively happened in the late 90s, when it looked, for a moment, like we might be moving toward a world at peace. In the U.S., for the last 50 years, whenever there seems to be any possibility of peace breaking out, the same thing happens. The emergence of a radical social movement dedicated to principles of direct action and participatory democracy, aiming to revolutionize the very meaning of political life. In the late 50s, it was the civil rights movement. In the late 70s, the anti-nuclear movement. This time it happened on a planetary scale and challenged capitalism head on. These movements tend to be extraordinarily effective. certainly the global justice movement was. Few realize that one of the main reasons it seemed to flicker in and out of existence so rapidly was that it achieved its principal goals so quickly. None of us dreamed when we were organizing the protests in Seattle in 1999 or at the IMF meetings in DC in 2000 that within a mere 3 or 4 years, the WTO process would have collapsed, that, you know, quote unquote, free trade ideologies would be considered almost entirely discredited, that every new trade pact they threw at us, from the MIA to free trade areas of the Americas Act, would have been defeated, the World Bank hobbled, the power of the IMF over most of the world's population effectively destroyed. But this is precisely what happened. The fate of the IMF is particularly startling. Once the terror of the Global South, it is, by now, a shattered remnant of its former self, reviled and discredited, reduced to selling off its gold reserves and desperately searching for a new global mission. Meanwhile, most of the quote-unquote third world debt has simply vanished. All of this was a direct result of a movement that managed to mobilize global resistance so effectively that the reigning institutions were first discredited, and ultimately that those running governments in Asia and especially Latin America were forced by their own populations to call the bluff of the international financial system. Much of the reason the movement was thrown into confusion was because none of us had really considered we might win. But of course, there's another reason. Nothing terrifies the rulers of the world, and particularly of the United States, as much as the danger of grassroots democracy. Whenever a genuinely democratic movement begins to emerge, particularly one based on principles of civil disobedience and direct action, the reaction is the same. The government makes immediate concessions. Fine, you can have voting rights, no nukes. Then starts ratcheting up military tensions abroad. The movement is then forced to transform itself into an anti-war movement, which, pretty much invariably, is far less democratically organized. So the civil rights movement was followed by Vietnam, the anti-nuclear movement by proxy wars in El Salvador and Nicaragua, the global justice movement by the quote-unquote war on terror. But at this point, we can see that war, for what it was, as the flailing and obviously doomed effort of a declining power to make its peculiar combination of bureaucratic war machines and speculative financial capitalism into a permanent global condition. If the rotten architecture collapsed abruptly at the end of 2008, it was at least in part because so much of the work had already been accomplished by a movement that had, in the face of the surge of repression after 9/11, combined with confusion over how to follow up its startling initial success, had seemed to have largely disappeared from the scene. Of course, it hasn't really. We are clearly at the verge of another mass resurgence of the popular imagination. It shouldn't be that difficult. Most of the elements are already there. The problem is that our perceptions, having been twisted into knots by decades of relentless propaganda, we're no longer able to see them. Consider here the term communism. Rarely has a term come to be so utterly reviled. The standard line, which we accept more or less unthinkingly, is that communism means state control of the economy. And this is an impossible utopian dream because history has shown it simply, quote unquote, doesn't work. Capitalism, however unpleasant, is thus the only remaining option. But in fact, communism really just means any situation where people act according to the principle of, from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. Which is the way pretty much everyone always act if they are working together to get something done. if two people are fixing a pipe and one says, hand me the wrench, the other doesn't say, and what do I get for it? That is, if they actually want it to be fixed. This is true even if they happen to be employed by Bechtel or Citigroup. They apply principles of communism because it's the only thing that really works. This is also the reason whole cities or countries revert to some form of rough and ready communism in the wake of natural disasters or economic collapse. One might say in these circumstances, markets and hierarchical chains of command are luxuries they can't afford. The more creativity is required, the more people have to improvise at a given task, the more egalitarian the resulting form of communism is likely to be. That's why even Republican computer engineers, when trying to innovate new software ideas, tend to form small democratic collectives. It's only when work becomes standardized and boring, as on production lines, that it becomes possible to impose more authoritarian, even fascistic forms of communism. But the fact is that even private companies are, internally, organized communistically. Communism, then, is already here. The question is how to further democratize it. Capitalism, in turn, is just one possible way of managing communism, and it has become increasingly clear, rather a disastrous one. Clearly, we need to be thinking about a better one, preferably one that does not quite so systematically set us all at each other's throats. All this makes it so much easier to understand why capitalists are willing to pour such extraordinary resources into the machinery of hopelessness. Capitalism is not just a poor system for managing communism. It has a notorious tendency to periodically come spinning apart. Each time it does, those who profit from it have to convince everyone, and most of all the technical people, the doctors and teachers and surveyors and insurance claims adjusters, that there is really no choice but to dutifully paste it all back together again in something like the original form. This despite the fact that most of those who will end up doing the work of rebuilding the system don't even like it very much, and all have at least the vague suspicion, rooted in their own innumerable experiences of everyday communism, that it really ought to be possible to create a system at least a little less stupid and unfair. This is why, as the Great Depression showed, the existence of any plausible-seeming alternative, even one so dubious as the Soviet Union in the 1930s, can turn a downswing into an apparently insoluble political crisis. Those wishing to subvert the system have learned by now, from bitter experience, that we cannot place our faith in states. The last decade has instead seen the development of thousands of forms of mutual aid association, most of which have not even made it onto the radar of the global media. They range from tiny cooperatives and associations to vast anti-capitalist experiments, archipelagos of occupied factories in Paraguay or Argentina, or of self-organized tea plantations and fisheries in India, autonomous institutes in Korea, whole insurgent communities in Chiapas or Bolivia, associations of landless peasants, urban squatters, neighborhood alliances that spring up pretty much anywhere that where state power and global capital seem to temporarily look the other way. They might have almost no ideological unity, and many are not even aware of the other's existence, but all are marked by a common desire to break with the logic of capital. In many places, they are beginning to combine. Economies of solidarity exist on every continent in at least 8 different countries. We are at the point where we can begin to perceive the outlines of how these can knit together on a global level, creating new forms of planetary commons to create a genuine insurgent civilization. visible alternatives shatter the sense of inevitability that the system must, necessarily, be patched together in the same form. This is why it became such an imperative of global governance to stamp them out, or, when that's not possible, to ensure that no one knows about them. To become aware of it allows us to see everything we are already doing in a new light. To realize we're all already communists when working on a common project, all already anarchists when we solve problems without recourse to lawyers or police, all revolutionaries when we make something genuinely new. One might object, a revolution cannot confine itself to this. That's true. In this respect, the great strategic debates are really just beginning. I'll offer one suggestion, though. For at least 5,000 years, popular movements have tended to center on struggles over debt. This was true long before capitalism even existed. There is a reason for this. Debt is the most efficient means ever created to take relations that are fundamentally based on violence and violent inequality and to make them seem right and moral to everyone concerned. When the trick no longer works, everything explodes. As it is now. Clearly, debt has shown itself to be the point of greatest weakness of the system, the point where it spirals out of anyone's control. It also allows endless opportunities for organizing. Some speak of a debtor's strike or a debtor's cartel. Perhaps so. But at the very least, we can start with a pledge against evictions, to pledge neighborhood by neighborhood to support each other if any of us are not to, or are to be driven from our homes. The power is not just to challenge regimes of debt, it is to challenge the very fiber of capitalism, its moral foundation, now revealed to be a collection of broken promises, but in doing so, to create a new one. A debt, after all, is only that, a promise, and the present world abounds with promises that have not been kept. One might speak here of the promise made us by the state, that if we abandon any right to collectively manage our own affairs, we would at least be provided with basic life security. Or of the promise offered by capitalism, that we could all live like kings if we were willing to buy stock in our own collective subordination. All of this has come crashing down. What remains is what we are able to promise to one another, directly, without the mediation of economic and political bureaucracies. The revolution begins by asking, what sort of promises do free men and women make to one another? And how, by making them, do we begin to make another world? That was a quick reading of the essay Hope in Common, written by anthropologist David Graeber, whose work we've talked about quite a lot on this show. Originally released by InfoShop, available at infoshop.org. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. You've been listening to The Anti here on WXRW LP River West Radio, 104.1 FM, Milwaukee. I've been NTSC, and I will be back again next week to discuss topics about freedom and our awesome shared potential. Past episodes can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti, and more can be learned about the show at riverwestradio.com. If you have been taking place in any of the earth strikes, it is my hope that we will all continue to do so. Organize with one another, help one another, and we're on our way to getting where we need to go. I'll talk to you all next week.